They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Shu Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights. On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Shu Bartholomew. Joining me today on the Commons is Mark Dos Santos. Mark, I think, is a bit of a glutton for punishment, or maybe he just likes to live on the wild side because he owns more than one house in an HOA. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome, Shu. It's a pleasure to be on here. Thank you for inviting me.
So, Mark, have you learned anything? I know that you've only got problems in one HOA, so the others, you're okay otherwise. What have you learned, and was there anything that perhaps you might have done when you were buying? Any questions, anything at all that might have made you think twice about buying in that particular HOA?
Yes, it's been a learning experience for sure, and a largely, I think, unnecessary learning experience, because none of these issues should happen. And I know that's the focus of, and by the way, I appreciate all you're doing to bring light to all of this, because I think it's a great service to everybody around the country. But as you mentioned, I own homes in four different HOAs, three of them are in Georgia, and one of them is in another state in the southeast. And what I learned, so first of all, the three that I own in Georgia, I really have no problems with it, other than, when I say problems, I don't think I've said anything at any board meetings. It's really not been an issue, although, we realize that we're living in these communities and they have certain rules, and you can definitely observe people that, there's some sort of a maybe tendency in human nature to want to control other people and control their property or whatnot. But it's not really been a problem for me in these other three communities. But it's this one that is, I think, the poster child for many, if not most, things that can go wrong in an HOA. And what I've learned is that, first of all, before buying in one of these communities, I would encourage everyone, and I'm saying this also for myself, to request the books and records and get, and do a review of them. And that would also serve as a litmus test, because if you have resistance at that point, you have the opportunity to fail fast, and maybe that's a sign that you should reconsider. Right, so one of them is just, reviewing the books and records and really understanding the financial, the state of the finances, but also the state of the board's willingness to cooperate with the law, the bylaws and the state laws. And
let me stop you here for a second, Mark, and let me ask you a question. I think most states have a disclosure requirement that when you buy a house in an HOA, they have to provide you with a package, a disclosure package with all of that information. Did you not get that package, or do you think that the information, if you did get the package, is the information adequate?
No, I don't. First of all, I don't recall getting the package. I don't believe we did.
Okay.
Of course, at the time, I wasn't really sensitive to, you know, looking for a lot of these things. I wasn't as wise. But it wouldn't surprise me. You know, there are many laws. There are many, you know, there are laws at the state level. And then, of course, there are the bylaws. And my experience is that in at least this HOA that I belong to, the one that's problematic, it really doesn't matter what the laws say, because they pretty much do whatever they want in blatant violation. They don't disclose when explicit record requests are made. They don't disclose the records. And I don't believe I was provided with the records, with any of those records when I bought. And So
you could have had a different board when you bought into it. You could have had an entirely different management team, company, philosophy, the whole thing. So you buy in, you look in there, and you request the information, and you get the information. And based on what you've read, it looks okay. But here you are 5 years down the road, and you've had a change of board, you've had a change of management, you've had a different attorney move in, and all of that. And you go and you say, okay, I want to see the books and records. And then you get the royal runaround. How does requesting that information when you buy actually help you? Does it help you?
Well, I think it would. I mean, I think it would help, and it would have helped from at least two perspectives. One is, if they resisted complying with that request up front, I think that would have put up a red flag, right? And that's, I almost, you know, would recommend that people do this as a test, right? Because if they're not going to comply with a simple records request as a prospective buyer, I think that that's a sign of trouble to come to, you know, when you become a homeowner. And then secondly, when you do get the books and records, you have an opportunity to really see how the state of the financial affairs of the HOA. And I actually think that what, you know, and I don't know if this may be something that would be relevant for some sort of regulatory reform, but I believe that there's an opportunity to maybe create a buyer's guide for prospective buyers in HOA that have a couple of questions that I think everybody should ask, which is, you know, the books and records. Number one, you know, do they have that? Do they have a reserve study? And, you know, can we see that? You know, have the board members signed a conflict of interest letter certifying that they don't have any relationships with vendors that do business at those in the community. You know, all of those things, I believe, you know, from transparency to conflicts of interest, those are the core of the issues that we're seeing, and they could have been prevented.
See, I think the point that I'm trying to make is that with every change, because boards usually, and I know we have some clingers who just get on the board and they're there until they're carried out feet first. But most associations, the board changes every year, 2 years, 3 years, whatever. And quite often the management company changes. And usually when the management company goes, the new one coming in says, oh, you know, you've got this attorney, but we like to work with this attorney, and we'd like to bring them on board. So you have a complete change. So in 2010, you look at the books and records. Everything looks copacetic. The board's really open. You know, anything you want, you get it. Everything looks great. 2012, you have a total change. And now you've got different board members, you've got a different management company, you've got a different attorney, and now when you go in, you know, you just run into this brick wall. Oh, and by the way, there's been a lot of embezzlement, and there's talk of a special assessment. So really, I guess I'm the point I'm trying to make is that that is no guarantee, because today everything may be fine, but like we like to say on this show, you're one election away from having it all turn around.
Right. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And there's another, I believe there's another phenomenon that is sort of, you know, well known in the security community probably, and in the also with investigators that that investigate fraud, for example, which is, I'm not sure exactly how they refer to it, but it's this principle wherein once impropriety starts to happen, it compromise, not only does it compromise the integrity of the system, in the intent of the or the finances themselves, but it also compromises the integrity of the relationships and the organizational dynamics. And what I mean by that is, you know, and I'm speaking from experience, what we're seeing in this community is that there's been extensive levels of you know, conflicts of interest between board members and vendor, and at least one vendor that does business at the community, and then there's been a lot of mishandled funds, and we've only found this through the discovery process of a lawsuit. We have, you know, there are probably 7 or 8 lawsuits at this community right now revolving around all these issues. So it's a real problem, and but what happens is once those improprieties happen, these people have a significant motive to try to keep them hidden. And then if you get a management company that comes in and has what I consider to be a wrong mindset, where they believe they see the board members as being their customers instead of the homeowners association of members. And I think it's almost like that, the last part of that HOA acronym is left off. It's not just an HOA, it's a homeowner association of members. It's the entire community should revolve around the members, not the management company, or for that matter, any of the vendors that do business there. And so what I think happens over time is that, and what I believe we're seeing here is that the management company and other commercial, you know, at least one other commercial entity, they collaborate and they collude together to maintain the status quo and to continue to try to cover things up. And that would motivate them to, for example, make sure that they stay on the board, because if there is a change of the guard, all of these secrets will be exposed. And that's sort of what I believe we're seeing here. And that's the danger. So it's a slippery slope.
Sometimes I'm well aware that management companies will do things that even the board is not aware of. And it's the board that has the fiduciary duty and responsibility to the association, basically.
Right.
And by extension, the members. But they're never told. I mean, you know, everything seems to be running smoothly. The manager's doing everything, gives his or her report, says everything is hunky-dory. Why would the board go out of their way to find out? Why would they go in and request things? Sometimes even the treasurer is not given the financial documents.
That's exactly right, Chu. And that's exactly what we're seeing. And that's the travesty here. I think, you know, you just nailed it. It would be one thing if a company were to mismanage or not deliver on a contract. I think it's another thing entirely where the scenario here is that this is a company that has been entrusted by the board of a nonprofit corporation to wisely manage the affairs of the corporation, and it's a quite a unique corporation in that it has members who are actually assessed and paying dues every month. So meant to manage millions of dollars of their money, and that management company then breaches that duty. And I actually think, and I'm not an attorney, but I believe that I've had an attorney tell me this, at least one attorney, that they actually believe that the management company also has a fiduciary duty. But I believe you're right that it's the board that has the primary, you know, there's a certain primacy of probably a fiduciary duty to the members. But when you have a management company that I think one way to describe it would be that they hijack the bank accounts, which this sounds almost unbelievable, but this is exactly what we're seeing, where we have, you know, they've taken over the bank accounts. Our own treasurer has requested access. The board, and they've ignored it, ignored those requests. The board voted to give her access, and she has a fiduciary duty that she now cannot fulfill because the management company is preventing her from doing that.
Wait a minute. Right? Let me make sure I understand this. The board voted to give the treasurer access to the books and records?
Well, it's actually not just the books and records, but it's primarily the bank accounts. So the
that would be part and parcel of the bank accounts, because that's the treasurer's job, is to make sure she's keeping an eye on the money.
That's right.
And so the board votes and says we will give you access. I mean, they shouldn't have to do that, but we give you access to the books and records. And the management company says, "Oh no, wait a minute, we don't agree." Is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah. Well, actually, specifically the bank accounts and certain bank statements. So the board actually voted for our treasurer, which you're right, it goes without saying, and it should go without a vote. I mean, by default, the treasurer, by definition, you know, it has responsibility for the financial affairs and to safeguard the money. And she does not have access to the bank accounts because the management company, which, by the way, is a very large publicly traded management company that shall remain nameless for now, maybe in a subsequent conversation after we get through all these, we're kind of in the middle of a sensitive part of the discovery that I don't really want to.
You know, they're all getting bigger. They're swallowing each other. They're eating each other. They're getting massive.
Right.
And we get smaller. We just keep shelling out more and more, and we have less access. So, yeah. No, I don't want you to name them because, you know, they'll change their name tomorrow or the next day.
Right. Right. So she doesn't have access to the bank accounts. And the problem with that is that she really doesn't know, and we really don't know, where our money really is. And all we get is the financial statements in the form of income statements and balance sheets from the management company. And I believe they're using an accrual basis of accounting, which means that, you know, it's hard to discern. They kind of, you know, combine, for example, receivables with actual cash balances. And it's hard to discern how much money we actually have in the bank and where that money is. And we've actually caught them having monies in excess of the $250,000 FDIC insurance limits in certain accounts, based on what they were telling us. You know, so it's a major problem. And like I said, it's unbelievable. And what's really frustrating is that it doesn't seem like there are any regulatory agencies or any agencies that would help enforce the laws that are on the books.
No.
Their answers, when you talk to the Secretary of State, for example, or I may have talked to a senior attorney on the Senate Judiciary Committee and the Department of Consumer Affairs, the only answer is you got to file a civil
lawsuit.
Civil action.
You agreed. This is what you agreed to, right? You bought that voluntarily. You agreed to being abused and harassed and robbed and all of that. Right. You agreed to it, right? And that's what they'll tell you.
That's what they say, but of course my position is I didn't agree to any of this. In fact, they're bound, I believe. Last time I checked, they're bound by the law to comply and they don't, but there's nobody that will enforce it. And it's it's not like this is, you know, if you were robbed or your house were robbed, you can call the police and they will investigate it. And, you know, even if it was for $50, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars here, and it feels like there's nowhere to turn other than a right. very expensive, very lengthy legal process,
right.
which I think is very wrong.
Right. Well, you know, this is what you get when you have the government that just shunts its responsibilities onto the private sector, doesn't have a clue as to what's going on, doesn't have a clue as to how to manage it or handle it, so they'll just send it back to you. And they'll
right.
say, okay, you agreed to this, it's a private matter, it's a civic matter, go file a lawsuit. Go find an attorney. That's a problem because very few attorneys will accept clients against their HOAs, and even fewer know what's understand what's involved. They have no idea how to litigate these things. So if you find a good attorney, hang on to them. They're worth their weight
right.
in gold. But very
right.
few of them will tackle them. Very few of them understand the issues. So, you're right. I mean, there's nothing. The government will not, absolutely will not come to your aid.
Right.
But keep contacting them. Keep contacting your legislators, your state senators, your assembly people, whatever you call them in your state, and just keep letting them know so that they understand there really is a problem.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we hope that, you know, we hope that there'll be more. And one of the things they say, Shu, which is quite disturbing because I have contacted some senators. In fact, I met with at least two of them. And, you know, the response is that, and maybe this is kind of along the lines of, you know, when if you're a carpenter and you only have a hammer, everything looks like a nail type of thing. But if you talk to a lot of these legislators, in my experience, they say, yeah, we agree, this is a massive problem. So, of course, they establish rapport and they say, we hear you, we understand this is a problem. And we are trying to get some legislative reform bills passed. And, of course, you know who's kind of who's opposing that with a large legislative action committee. It's CAI.
Actually, they're writing all the bills, Mark. They're writing all the bills.
Right, exactly. But you know, I think the position, and this is the other thing. I think that we need to raise awareness to not allow that answer to sit, because I don't believe. You know, I believe the first answer is, can you please enforce the laws that are already on the books? Because it doesn't seem to make sense to pass any kind of act of Congress or any other laws if they don't have any wherewithal to enforce the laws that are already on the books. And to me, it just seems like a cop out to defer and deflect those kinds of requests into some sort of effort to legislate new bills when they don't legislate the most or they don't enforce the most basic of, you know, transparency laws that are already on the books.
Yeah, I think what probably should happen is we ought to try to get them to go in and enforce the stuff that is not part of an HOA, because you will have a whole lot of HOA-related legislation throughout the country. And these would be bills that were written by CAI for CAI against the homeowner. So they'll go and they'll say, well, you know, here it is. This is what, you know, this is the way you're supposed to handle this. But if you go to the regular, you know, okay, here's the criminal act. You know, stealing is a crime. If you went into a 7-Eleven and stole a pack of bubble gum, they'd be all over you. But if you have
right.
someone in stealing $3 million out of your funds, that's a private matter. Come on, what's wrong with that picture? What's wrong with that picture?
Right.
But that's a business. Well, isn't 7-Eleven a business as well? Yet we'll protect 7-Eleven from being robbed of a pack of bubble gum. But when you're being robbed, the homeowners, of $3 million, then that's a business and you're on your own? What kind of answer is that?
Exactly.
What kind of government is that?
Right. I agree. And it's that's what we're up against. It's a little bit daunting to think that there is a trade association that is the CAI, that, you know, they wake up every day, and they go about their business, which is, you know, to make profit, you know, around the HOA ecosystem. And that in and of itself is perfectly fine. I think we need businesses to service the HOAs, and that's fine. But when they get together and they create a legislative action committee to inhibit any actions that would create more accountability, then we have a major problem. You know, and this is affecting, I understand that there, you know, from the CIA's own statistics, that there are over 60 million people now, and that number's rising, living in these communities. And, you know, I don't want to sound overly dramatic here, but I do believe that this could very well be one of the biggest threats to our form of representative democracy here. If you have this layer of sort of a quasi-government, where I think it actually is a government, injecting itself between, you know, at your doorstep, between homeowners and the next level of government, which could be the local municipality, and they basically have a crack at your income, basically, right? I mean, they have the power to tax. It's a form of representative democracy. Yet there are no, without any of the restraints that are applied to any of the other levels of government.
That's because you agreed, right? You said, I don't need any of my constitutional protections. I sign off. I buy into this wonderful, carefree living place. By the way, you just mentioned CAI's own numbers, stats about how many homeowners and how many homes and how many associations and all of that. They don't even know. I have a friend who is a broker in Chicago, and she has a couple of broker real estate related businesses, and they have found associations that are not part of CAI stats. So I think there are a lot more people and a lot more associations involved than CAI stats.
Right.
But then for the
last
40 years, local municipalities have been mandating them. Mr. Developer, you build in my district, you will provide an HOA. Because we don't want to do anything for the money, the property taxes we collect.
Right. And that, you know, that's really actually is interesting, because it extends to basic services that, since the beginning of time, when taxation, you know, ever since taxation was invented, I believe that the first dollars were prioritized to provide basic infrastructure services like, you know, maintenance of the roads and perhaps security, like in the form of police. I mean, those are some of the basic services that I think anybody, especially in a modern world and especially in a first world country, would expect. Yet in these communities, when you put a gate up at the front, like we have in this particular community, and then we provide our own security, the great irony, and this sounds unbelievable as well, but it's absolutely true. And in fact, there was a press release that was investigated by a local news agency a few months ago. But the same company, management company, has basically spun off, or, you know, has introduced itself to provide other services beyond just management. And I think this is one of the problems, is that when you have a management company that creates additional services like maintenance, for example, and security, for example, and then has maybe a affiliated company mm-hmm. that provides insurance brokerage services. And guess who gets those mm-hmm. those contracts every yeah. year? And do you think that they actually put those things out to competitive bid? Absolutely not. That we had those services are not being put out to bid. But the problem that we're having around security is that this same company, you know, even despite multiple complaints about hiring practices within the management services function of the company, where they, you know, homeowners became aware that perhaps they weren't doing appropriate background checks, they actually hired a number of maintenance workers. And this is the same company that, again, it has a division that provides our security services. So we're actually paying them to provide security while they're hiring people with severe criminal histories. We had one maintenance worker in particular that had access to the master key of over, you know, 200 units, 200 homes, who was released on bond for first-degree murder, first-degree burglary, and
wow.
criminal conspiracy, and has since pled guilty to the first-degree burglary charges, and he had previous charges where he pled guilty to possession with intent to distribute crack cocaine. And this is the person that has had been given by the management company the master key to the homes. I told you it would sound unbelievable, but that's what actually happened. And they will not acknowledge that master key has been compromised.
That, you know, you've told me this, and you're not the only one. I have heard so many stories about what goes on. Sometimes it's funny. I have a friend who was doing some research, and he discovered one condominium where they were discussing, or a website where they were actually discussing giving a key to the condo. And the guy says, mm-hmm. I'll give my front door key to the condominium, but then I add another lock. And when they try to get in and they can't get in, they want a key to that lock. So I'll give them a key to that lock, and then I'll add another lock. So his door must be nothing but locks all the way up and down.
Well, you know, if just to finish that story, by the way, on the back end of it, after they were forced to acknowledge that yes, they hired this individual, and yes, this individual had this criminal record. Of course, the question became, well, you know, what are you going to do now, right? They needed to notify the homeowners, communicate something to them. So they let a few months go by, and then, as if all of what they did was not brazen enough, right? They then sent an email out to the community, and in the very first paragraph, there was no apology anywhere. The first paragraph, and I believe maybe there was a subject line of the message, but at least in the first paragraph, it began with a reminder to the homeowners of their right to access all units, you know, immediately.
Their right to access all units?
Immediately, yeah. So
you mean the condos?
You know, just wanted to
the condos, right.
Yeah, all condos.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so instead of, you know, homeowners would have expected something in the form of, you know, an acknowledgement and recognition that there's been a security breach, and that they apologized for that, and that they were taking corrective actions, and maybe specify a few of the corrective actions that they were taking, to include changing the locks. And instead of doing that, they started with a reminder that, hey, everyone, we have the right to enter any unit for, you know, I think they were talking about pest control or something, and they can do it. They can enter immediately without even notifying the homeowners. I mean, it was so, what would you call that? Almost like tone deaf. You know, and then they went on to say, hey, we had a security breach, but we don't believe that, you know, the key has been compromised. And of course, homeowners are free to change their locks if they like. That was the response. I consider that to be very, you know, very abusive. You know, the entire scenario, especially their reaction to it. And again, there's just no accountability. And so now we're all left with, to this, at this moment, none of those, they haven't changed any of those locks. Some homeowners perhaps changed the locks, but they've not taken any responsibility.
They don't. It's unfortunate, but, you know, nothing you're telling me is surprising in the least. And they say that they need to have access to your unit. But I think in case of an emergency. But in case of an emergency, they can always break the door down. I think it's totally wrong to have to give your key or to have a key to your unit. The abuses that I have been told about from homeowners of what was going on in, you know, when the association used the master lock to get in and use their, one guy said that the association, the condominium, had hired a group of people to come in and make some repairs and change windows or whatever. And so they opened up his unit because they didn't like him. And they told all the workers that they could go to the bathroom in his unit. So he came home to a filthy bathroom. All the workers were just trudging through his unit, using his bathroom, and getting, you know, I mean, that kind of abuse is terrible. And then they played with a woman's mind. Every day when she went, every time she went out, she packed a suitcase. And she carried the suitcase around with her because people would go in and she was afraid that all her valuable paperwork and valuable stuff would get stolen. So all of that stuff went into a suitcase and she pulled it around with her wherever she went. We went out to lunch. She had the suitcase, a big suitcase, sitting there. She said every time she walked into her unit, somebody had been in and they'd moved things.
Right.
So they'd taken...
Yeah, we've had...
Taken the bowl off a coffee table and put it on a side table. They've taken the lamp from the bedroom. And, you know, and just to make her feel like she had lost her mind... And they do things like that. They do things like that, which is terrible.
It certainly is. And, you know, this is the sanctity of people's homes. And it is, you know, it is the thing that is, it's the most, you know, it should be respected. And it's been the thing that over time that, you know, everybody feels a certain amount of, should be able to feel safe in their homes, right? Not that somebody's going to be coming through the door at any minute unannounced, which is what happens. But, you know, the interesting thing is that these issues are not happening in isolation, as I think some of these people would like you to believe. And I think, you know, I'm just presuming, and I think I've heard examples from other people that, resistance to, you know, the other side, let's say, would say that, you know, this is a group of just, you know, a group of disgruntled homeowners, and they succeed in doing all these things by dividing homeowners in sort of like a divide and conquer approach.
Yeah.
The reality is that, and I think we need more, and I think this is why you're providing a tremendous service to, you know, this nation in helping create transparency to these issues. And it also, I mean, your platform of communication here is also helping bring the community together because we're getting to meet each other, for example, and understand that these are not isolated incidents and that these are systemic. To the contrary, they're actually systemic issues. And, you know, this same management company, for example, I recently, you know, doing a little bit of searching around Google and YouTube, I found that they are involved, you know, they're being sued in, you know, at least one other state by a number of homeowners associations for exactly the same issues.
Yeah, yeah.
Yet these attorneys and these individuals like myself and these other homeowners are pursuing these actions in isolation. And, you know, at some point, I just wonder, and I think there needs to be an effort to bring us together so that we can have these issues addressed at the appropriate level, which I believe is, you know, a consolidated effort to, you know, whether it be through legal action or through regulatory action or other agency enforcement, to mitigate this and mitigate all the damages, because the damages are absolutely massive, absolutely massive.
So how long have you been involved in all of this? See, I started this in the late 80s, 88, I think, when I got involved or started understanding what HOAs were all about. I've said this on the show before, I'll say it again. I have never been targeted, so I don't know what it's like to be in the crosshairs of an HOA. So, I mean, I really don't. I appreciate what everybody else is going through, and I sort of learned about it through talking to people. But when I got started, we didn't have the internet. People didn't have computers. I mean, that this is all so new. So meeting other people, even in your own association, was difficult. So you're there fighting on your own. You're there being targeted on your own. And they'll say, oh, we're so sorry that you feel that way because you're the only one. And you start thinking, oh, my gosh, what's wrong with me? If everybody loves this, there must be something wrong with me. No, seriously. But when I got involved and got started, we had to go to the library. And in those days, libraries carried newspapers from around the country. And so you would read these stories in the newspapers if the newspapers actually published these stories. And that's how you realized that this was going on. But then trying to find these people was a different story altogether. Everything changed when we had internet and emails, and so all of a sudden you started to see that these are not isolated incidents, and it's not just you. So we've come a really, really long way. It's so much easier now to understand and know what's going on. You're not scratching your head saying, is there something wrong with me? Am I the one who's wrong here? Is everybody else right? So how long have you been involved in this? I mean, you seem to have done a lot of homework and a lot of research because you're really well up on the issues.
Yeah, well, you know, these issues only came to light to me about 2 years ago when I started noticing some, which at the time, which just appeared to be questionable relationships, as I mentioned earlier, between the board, certain board members, and at least one of the vendors is doing business on the board. And, you know, my sense was that, wow, you know, there's a fundamental lack of awareness, which it goes to your point, right, that there's, you know, just awareness is the first step. It's awareness and participation because, and I believe that, you know, for any representative democracy, the healthy functioning of it depends on an informed electorate. And so if the electorate is not informed, well, they don't know, you know, and then you have your typical, the biggest threat to any of these organizations or any of these governments at any level, I believe, is just lack of participation. And lack of participation is only amplified in communities where, like this particular one, which is kind of a vacation community, it's kind of a resort sort of type of community, where many of the homeowners are either, most of them, by the way, are retirees, which I think that demographic could be perhaps more prone to, you know, predatory practices to begin with. But then also, most of them are absentee owners, meaning that they live in other parts of the country.
Yeah.
And so these people that wake up every day and they operate, you know, at the resort or at the HOA, which is the resort community, doing whatever it is that they do, doing their various functions of the, you know, the management company, the property management company, the insurance, they're focused on maximizing their profits at the expense of, you know, of the homeowners. And you know, violating a lot of the bylaws, and nobody's aware. So when the elections come around, people just vote for the incumbents, and the process just keeps happening. And all of the misconduct that's happened is invisible to most people. And it's kind of like lurking underneath the rocks. And whenever somebody comes along and turns on the light and turns on a spotlight, these people get very nervous. They get very nervous. They get anxious, and then they retaliate. And they will retaliate when you point out what, you know, when you start asking questions, they're going to try to silence you. And when you, if you try to assemble a group of homeowners, or you petition for a redress of these grievances, they will retaliate. And so, I mean, they've sued me for what I believe and what our attorneys believe it is a base, you know, meritless defamation lawsuit, where they identified the petition, but they wouldn't identify any specific statements of fact that we made in that petition that are false. And this has been carrying on for over a year and a half now. So that's what sort of makes this whole thing even worse.
So they filed the lawsuit, but you haven't been to court yet?
No, we haven't been to court yet. And we've been asking them to identify the statements that they allege that we made that's false, and they haven't done that. Their response to that has been, read the complaint. Like, read the lawsuit. It's in the lawsuit, but it's not. So, you know, if it's a genuine complaint, I respect everybody's right to file, you know, to use the court system and file a complaint by all means. But it better be legit. You know, it better be, you know, you should be genuine about it. If we said something that was false, and first of all, I would expect that you come to me and say, hey, you said that, you know, give us the opportunity to correct it. But instead they went, and by the way, the petition, it was for an audit of the books and records. It was only after, and it was reviewed by our attorney before we sent numerous emails. They ignored every one. We went to the attorney. The attorney sent numerous letters to the board. They ignored outlining the key points where we found there were issues with the books and records. They ignored all of those. And then when our attorney actually suggested that we create a petition to get support of the homeowners, and we had signatures representing over 330 or 340 homeowners, when they found out that we did the petition, that's when they just, their answer to that request for an audit in the petition was in the form of a lawsuit, you know, where they were, and by the way, when I say they, it's the management company that filed the lawsuit.
Oh, the management company is filing a lawsuit against one of their clients.
But yeah, against, including, you know, against six or seven homeowners, including two board members, for petitioning for an audit.
Any requirement in the governing documents for an audit? I mean, there should be. CAI will tell you, oh, it's just too expensive. We can't expect the homeowners to pay for it. We'll just let them get robbed by millions of dollars. But we can't have audits, right?
I'm not sure if there is a specific requirement in the bylaws, but they do what they call an audit every year. The problem is that I think the definition and scope of an audit is very, seems at least to me to be quite subjective to the person who's controlling the audit. And guess who's controlling the audit? The management company.
The audit should go to a separate.
It does, but that firm is selected, and it's a very small firm, by the way. Very small local firm. It's selected by the management company.
Yeah, it should be selected by the board. They ought to go out to bid. They ought to present the bids to the board. The board ought to do that, and when the audit is returned, make sure there's a management letter attached to it, because that's
right
where you're going to find out exactly what's going on.
Right. Well, you know, we paid, so we did. So they claim, and we do have these audits that are done every year. But the question is, and we're going to find out. I mean, we will find out through the discovery process how this audit and what the scope was, who signed off on it, everything else. But the management company controls the audit, so they effectively can control the scope of the audit. They select the auditor, and then they come back, and of course they give us a clean bill of health every year. Now, the problem with that is that a year ago, or a little over a year ago, actually, two new board members, who, by the way, are the subject target of this lawsuit as well, within about a month or so of being on the board, and by the way, these two board members are not, you know, they're not, you know, auditors. They don't have any particular, I mean, I think one of them has a bit of an accounting background, but they didn't really do a very in-depth, with a very superficial look at the books. They found that this management company was not billing another property management company who operates a lot of the amenities, including a restaurant. It's supposed to operate actually a number of small restaurants in the community. That other company was not paying. You know, they have a commercial lease and they lease a bunch of the property. That they were not paying utilities. So the homeowners were paying utilities for this commercial entity. The management company was not billing them. It's clearly obvious in the commercial lease agreement that they were supposed to be paying utilities. And it was over $60,000 in utilities that this management company had not billed this commercial entity for. And how did that slip through the audit? Or not the audit. It was not one audit, actually. It was like at least five or six audits.
Wow.
You paid thousands of dollars a year for each audit. And something as simple and basic as that slipped through the cracks.
Did you get the management letter?
Yeah, I mean, we have all the audit letters saying that you had a clean, you know, that they reviewed the. My understanding is that the scope may have been, when you look at the audit letter, it says that they reviewed the financial statements and they found them to be, you know, adequate or in accordance with whatever accounting standards.
Generally
but
accepted
to me,
practices, the gaps.
Yeah, exactly, gap and other things. But
yeah.
I would think that. Why wouldn't we want them to do the audit in light of the various obligations of the resort and the contracts with the major vendor that is supposed to be serving the homeowners? They didn't even do that. And a very cursory examination of those contracts, I would say, you know, I would imagine within an hour of being handed the books and records, if they included the contracts and if they included the income statements, you could have found this. This could have been found. But it took the board members to find it. And then after they found it, of course, there was a significant amount of resistance to, you know, repay the entirety of the amount. Anyway, that's why we – and so that gave rise to this desire. It's like, look, if the audits that we've had didn't find this, then we want a more in-depth audit, and that's why we created the petition. And sure enough, through the discovery process, we've gotten a lot of the financials, and I don't want to go into the details now, but suffice it to say that we believe that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot more stuff that we found.
That's what I sort of use that wording, the tip of the iceberg, because I think that there's so much more going on that we really don't know about. And we've never even thought, because our minds don't work that way, of the different ways that we can be fleeced. And that's exactly what's happening there, Mark. But listen, we're
yep.
about seconds away from the end of the show. I want to thank you so much for coming on and for telling us your story and your observations, because it's always good for fresh eyes and new experiences to share that with us. And I know you're going through a number of lawsuits right now, but I would like you to promise to come back at a later date and tell us about what's going on, what happened, and don't take any wooden nickels while you're at it, right?
Exactly. No, it'd be my pleasure, Shu. I would be happy to come back, and I'll have an update for you by then as well.
Well, good luck with everything. Thank you so much, Mark. and talk to you again soon. Keep in touch.
Thank you, Shu. Likewise.
Bye.
Take care. Okay, bye.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.